Hi. I want to thank all y'all for coming out this morning and being here. I have a couple things I need to tell you before we get started. I was set out on a spiritual journey last night, and it kept me away from my bed, and I didn't make it to bed till about 5 o'clock this morning, so here we sit on about 3 hours sleep. So this talk could be 15 minutes or 2 hours and 15 minutes, who knows. So y'all please help me to stay awake and stay awake with me. Before I get started, I need to tell you that my home group supports a mentoring group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're a men's stag. We study the big book in the 12 and 12. We meet at 8:15 in North Houston on Tuesday night. And if you're ever in North Houston on a Tuesday night, you are more than welcome to attend. The Fourth Dimension group just happens to be, to me, the best group in the known universe. And I hope that you feel that way about your home group. And, you know, the fact that three of the six people here this morning are from my home group, and one of them is an ex-home group member, I'd say I got a pretty good home group to get out at this early hour and come down here and support me. I want to thank y'all for that. Before I get started, I want to thank the committee. We have one committee member here. I want to thank you for asking me to come and to share. It's always a great honor and a great privilege to have the opportunity to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it doesn't matter where or when it is. AA is the program that saved my life, and I owe it a great debt of gratitude, and have the opportunity to be at the podium of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is more than I could have ever imagined when I made it here. I want to thank the committee for having me here to speak. I'd also like to thank the committee. Chuck, I'll just talk to you. Chuck, I'd also like to thank you guys in Austin for all your work that you've done on Texipa and for keeping this conference alive and for having it here the last couple of years. And I attended my first Texipa in 1983 in this hotel. It was actually called A-Trip then. We changed the name a few years later. It was the annual Texas Roundup of Young People in AA. And I was not quite a year sober. And the conference was in this hotel, and on that dance floor, I danced all night long, and was dripping sweat, and, had a real experience that, that moved my sobriety. And that was my beginning of my experience with Texipa. Since then, I guess there's been 17, 16 more of them, and I haven't missed any of them. So it's always, it's always near and dear to me to see Texipa continue to survive. And in 1988, I went on the advisory council for Texipa and served 5 years and was involved with hosting a couple of the Texipas here in Austin. So, I just appreciate you guys keeping this thing alive and keeping it moving. I want to thank Chris for the future of Texipa, because I understand that he'll be involved with hosting. Oh, that's a secret. I'm sorry. I let the cat out of the bag. I understand the token bid went firm. So, right. I also need to tell you all that I have about a 1 hour bladder, and considering that I slammed about 3 cups of coffee, this talk may be shortened by that fact. So, y'all bear with me if I begin to dance around up here and cross my legs. The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, says I should share with you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today, and I'm going to try to do that. And if I'm successful, of course, in the next, 45 minutes or so, you're going to know me in a very intimate way, and you're going to know me in a way that a lot of my family members don't, a lot of people who knew me for a long time don't. We share several things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's our common problem that brings us here, and the fact that we're alcoholics, and that's what brings us to Alcoholics Anonymous. But what keeps us here and what keeps us close is that we share a common solution. And that solution is the relationship with a loving God, as it's expressed through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so hopefully what I'm going to be able to convey to you in the next short while is what I was like and what happened to me, and what recovery's been like for me and what Alcoholics Anonymous has meant to me. I started drinking at a really young age. My first drink, I don't remember my first drink. I grew up in an alcoholic family. My father was an alcoholic. My first drink, Dad sent me to the icebox for a beer, and I popped the top on the way back and sucked the head off of it. I did that often, and it was cute, and it was harmless, and it was just real social. And that was the beginning of my social drinking. I was probably 7 or 8 years old at the time. At age 10, I stole a bottle of vodka out of my parents' liquor cabinet. And I was out walking the streets of the neighborhood that I grew up in, and I was sipping on that bottle, and I was acting giddy, and I was acting goofy. I knew how drunks acted, and I was acting the part. And I came across two young girls, and I don't know what they said, but what I heard was, "We'll really like you if you drink it all." So that's what I did. And I got to tell you how I felt at age 10 for this story to make sense. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it describes us as being irritable, restless, and discontent. and we find the sense of ease and comfort that comes with a few drinks. And the fact of the matter is, for me, before I made it to that first drink, what I suffered from was a lack of power. You know, I had a lack of power. I had a hole in my chest that the wind whistled through, and I didn't feel like I was as good as, and I didn't feel like I fit in, I didn't feel like I was a part of. I hurt, and I was frightened, and I was insecure. I was irritable, I was restless, and I was discontent. And that day, at 10 years old, standing out in that street, I found a power greater than myself. I found a power that changed my life never to be the same again. From the very beginning, for me, alcohol wasn't the problem, it was the solution. The problem was for me was the way that I felt when I wasn't drinking. And I threw that bottle up, and I didn't let it loose till it was all gone. And it was a red-letter day. I blacked out, passed out, and threw up. And that was the beginning of my alcoholic drinking. And I got to tell you that that was not a bad experience for me. In a matter of moments, in a matter of seconds, from the time I put that bottle to my lips to the time it hit my stomach and it erupted in my stomach and shot through every vein in my body, something happened. In a matter of moments, I was 10 foot tall and I was bulletproof. In a matter of moments, I was funny and I was cute and I was handsome and I was everything I ever wanted to be. In a matter of moments, I was the captain of the football team and the chairman of the class and everything else. I was everything I ever wanted to be. Like I said, I found my solution right there that day, and I'm grateful for alcohol. I'll tell you the truth, the way I felt at age 10 and the way I felt growing up, I don't know if I'd have made it. I don't know if I wouldn't have blown my brains out somewhere along the way, because I was so miserable being me. And I'm not going to try to BS y'all and tell y'all that at age 10 I started hopping on the big wheel and riding down to the beer joint, you know. It just wasn't that way, but the fact of the matter is that's the way that I drank every opportunity that I had. I drank as much as there was, as fast as there was. So, in the, you know, we talk about in AA that we cross this invisible line from social drinker to real alcoholic. So for me at 7, 8, and 9, you know, I was a social drinker, and at 10 I became a real alcoholic. And that was, by the time I was 14 years old, though, I'd been arrested with 4 ounces of marijuana possession with intent to sell. I had been, arrested for shoplifting, breaking and entering. I had dropped out of the school in the ninth grade. I had moved out of my parents' house. And the fact of the matter is that I was in the full grips of a progressive illness and had no idea. At age 14, I was in the full grips of alcoholism and didn't have a clue what it was. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in the doctor's opinion, it says we have a mental obsession that's coupled by a physical craving. At age 14, I had a mental obsession. And what that meant for me is that when I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking. And that's the fact of the matter. Is when I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking. And once I started drinking, I lost all control of what would happen next. And that's the way that it was. I'd like to tell y'all, I'm going to take this jacket off. I'd like to tell y'all that I was a pure alcoholic, because it seems like maybe it's a better story in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the fact of the matter is I used other substances in a way, as well as alcohol. I know that's hard to believe. Of course, I think anybody under the age of about 60 today in Alcoholics Anonymous has probably used substances other than alcohol. But I, you know, the fact of the matter is it didn't really matter. If it changed the way I felt and it changed my perception of morality, I was all about it. I'd drink it, drop it, shoot it, snort it, shove it. It just didn't matter. It changed my perception of reality and the way that I felt. I was all about it. And I can never say shove it without somebody laughing because they've heard the story before. But and it is a men's meeting, so I mean, the shove it story, I'm not going to tell the ugly story, but I will tell the shove it story. How's that? And it does speak to how it is that I drank and used, because like I said, the fact of the matter is I was a slut. You know, it didn't matter. I would do it. And I'm in junior high school. I'm probably in the eighth grade. I don't really remember that part. And when you're a young, and I'm sure you guys know, when you're a young alcoholic and drug addict, you learn all kinds of creative ways to stay in our preferred state. You know, it's not up for us. You know, we don't have the option of going to the 7-Eleven and buying a six-pack of beer, you know, or like I said, going to the bar and drinking with the big fellas, you know. So we find all kinds of ways to stay in our preferred state. And if you're a young alcoholic, you learn that in mama's medicine chest, which ones are the ones that make you feel good, you know. And you learn how you can go to your best friend's house and you can sneak into his mama's medicine chest and you learn which ones make you feel good. You learn if it has that big sleepy eye on it. It's good stuff, you know. You learn if it has that do not operate heavy machinery. It's a hookup, you know. And I'm at school in the eighth grade, and a buddy of mine comes up to me and he says, "Whoa, dude, I scored." I'm like, "Really?" He said, "Oh, I got some killer stuff out of my mom's medicine cabinet." I was like, "Hook me up." I put out my hand, and this guy put this thing in my hand. It's kind of long and pointy on one end and flat on the other. And I said, "How do you swallow this, man?" He said, "You don't swallow it. It's a suppository." I didn't know what a suppository was. I said, "What are you talking about, man?" He said, "You know, you stick it. You know, you shove it." I was like, "Really?" said, will this make me high? I said, yeah. I said, give me two. But that's the fact of the matter, and that's the way it was for me. And by the time I was 19 years old, I was living in a flop house in North Houston, and I had disenfranchised most of my friends and family. I was living in an apartment with a bunch of other drug addicts and alcoholics, and we were lying and cheating and stealing and doing whatever we had to do to stay high and stay drunk. And you know, if I'd have known I was going to talk about it so much, I'd have probably done something more glamorous. You know, I'd have probably robbed a bank, or you know, done something, you know, robbed a pharmacy, done something really cool. You know, we just didn't do anything that neat, you know. We did things like go to the bar and drink OPs. I don't know if you ever drink OPs or not. OPs are when you go to the bar and you keep an eye on somebody and they, you know, set their full drink down because they're going to go, you know, make time with a good-looking girl, and you walk up with your empty glass and set it next down to their full glass, and you pick up their full glass and walk off. OP! We drank OPs, and we, like I said, we lie and we cheat and we steal and we rob and we do whatever we had to do. My parents had, they had pretty much written me off. You know, they really didn't want anything to do with me. My mom was a good untreated Al-Anon. She enabled me just as much as she possibly could. There are limits to that. There are limits to what a mother can do. You know, there's only so many times you can steal your mama's TV before you're not invited back for Christmas dinner. It's just a fact of the matter. You know, it's three TVs in my family and you're out. And you know, mom had pretty much written me off. They really didn't want anything to do with me. I disenfranchised myself with most people that I knew because of the way that I drank and I used. I wasn't able to work and wasn't able to do much more. But my father did send somebody to get me. They were worried about me. I wasn't doing very well. And back then at 19, I was 6'3" and I weighed 135 pounds. I had this long hair that was down on my back, and it was kind of in this ringlet perm thing, you know. I mean, I thought I was really cool, you know. I thought I looked like Peter Frampton or, you know, Robert Plant or somebody, you know. But my nickname was Q-Tip, which pretty accurately described my appearance. And my dad sent somebody that worked for him over to get me, and the guy came and picked me up and took me out of that flop house and took me to a little redneck town north of Houston called Conroe, Texas. Any of y'all from Houston know where Conroe is? Yeah, Brian's from Conroe. South Conroe, right, yeah. He took me up to a little town north of Houston called Conroe, Texas, thought to get me out in the country to do me some good. And first thing he did was got me something to eat. I hadn't eaten in a while, and that was really nice. And he went and took and got me a haircut. It was more like a sheep shearing than it was a haircut. And they, you know, shaved off all my long locks. And the next thing he did was he found me a place to live. And it was on the east side of Conroe, on the wrong side of the tracks, and it was a trailer. And when I say it was a trailer, I'm not talking about a double wide on an acre of land. I'm talking about a trailer you pull behind the car. In fact, it was the first trailer ever made. It was vintage 1949 travel trailer. It had a bed on one end and a bath on the other and a shower and a kitchenette in between. The faucets leaked all the time, and the windows stayed fogged up from the hot water running all the time, and had a little black and white TV with aluminum foil on the aerials, and that was my casa. It rented for $50 a month, if that tells you anything what this place was like. The next thing Frank did was, because he was helping me to get my life in order, you see, the next thing he did was he took me and got me a job. And there was a guy that owed my dad some favors, and the guy reluctantly agreed to give me a job. And it was a county job. If you're an alcoholic, and I know there's a lot of state employees here in Austin, but if you're an alcoholic, a city job, a county job, a state job, those are great places for an alcoholic to hide out. Dave, the ex-county employee, can attest to that. Anyway, it was a county job, and I'd like to say it was something that was fitting to my experience and my abilities. And the fact of the matter was at the county sewage treatment plant, and I hired on as the washdown man at the county sewage treatment plant. So I was the chief churchager with a water hose, and that was where actually they hired me as a mechanic. I was going to work on things, you see. But when you work on things at the sewage treatment plant, what they do is they give you tools and you go up on top of the plant to work on things. And back then I shook. I mean, I shook like a leaf on a tree. I mean, it was just, I vibrated, and they'd give me these tools and I'd go up on the plant and I'd go boop, and you drop them, they're gone, you know. After about the third set of tools, they demoted me to washdown guy. They gave me a water hose, didn't think I could lose that. And that's where I spent the last year of my drinking. I was living in that little trailer in North Conroe, or in East Conroe, and I was working at the county sewage treatment plant. The job really worked out well for me. I was fortunate. The guy that I worked for also happened to be an alcoholic. So it wasn't a bad deal. And in the mornings he would come over there and he would, get me up. He'd give me a ride to work. And if I didn't get out of bed, he'd just, you know, kind of rock the side of the trailer and, you know, roll me out on the floor. And, I'd stumble outside. And usually what I could convince him is that on the way to the wastewater treatment plant, what we needed to do was to smoke a fatty. So we'd burn one on the way to the wastewater treatment plant to start the day out good. And usually by noon I could convince him what we needed to do was to have a few beers. So usually by noon we'd start drinking and, we'd spend the rest of the day drinking and smoking and, you know, hanging out at the sewer plant. And he'd take me back to that trailer at night. And that's where I'd spend my weeks. And then Friday would roll around, and Friday was payday. So Friday I'd be back down in Houston. I'd be in the bars and in the dope houses and doing all the things it is that I do. And, back then I was 19, and 19 was a legal drinking age in Texas. The drinking age tracked me there for a few years because when I was 18, the legal drinking age was 18, and when I turned 19 in August, and they changed the law in September, and it turned to 19. So I had 2 years of, legal alcoholism. But I'd be, on Fridays I'd end up back down in those beer joints and bars and dope houses, and I would be doing my same old stuff. And by Monday I'd be broke, and sometimes I'd make it back up to that trailer and sometimes I wouldn't. And sometimes I'd wake up on a park bench, and sometimes I'd wake up in somebody's house. I had no idea where I was. And sometimes I'd wake up in jail, and sometimes I'd actually happen to make it home. And, wasn't anything glamorous about it, wasn't anything pretty, but that's the way I spent the last year of my drinking. I'd go to that little trailer at night, and on the way we'd stop at a little Stop and Rob up on the corner, and, the guy had trusted me with credit, and so I would get, you know, a 6-pack or 12-pack or whatever I could for the night, and I'd go back to that little trailer and I'd sit in there by myself and drink it. Alcoholism can be a very, very lonely disease. It can be a very, very lonely disease. And, I had one real friend left in the world, and he was my real friend because he was as big a loser as I was, and, that real friend was Mitch, and Mitch was from California. I had this habit, and like the last 6 months of my drinking, I went to jail 6 or 8 times for public intoxication. That's not an exaggeration. I don't know the exact number. But I had this habit back then. They had these little pills back then called Mandrax. I don't know if you're familiar with those or not. But Mandrax and beer make a nice combination. They will cause you to slobber on yourself. They will cause you to go to sleep in strange places. And they caused me to be in my preferred state, which was, you know, tongue chewing, slobbering on myself, puking drunk. I mean, that's what they caused me to do. They were an accelerator to the alcohol for me. And so I'd take those funny little pills and I'd drink that booze and think I could function in the world, and nobody else seemed to think I could function in the world, so they'd take me to jail. And I'd sleep it off in jail, for public intoxication. And, Mitch came to me on one of those Fridays and he said, you know, he had the answer. He knew what it was that we needed to do, and what it was we needed to do was we needed to go to California. He was from California. And so Mitch told me, this was my first attempt at a geographic cure, but Mitch told me that, I guess moving to Conroe was my first geographic, it was my second geographic. Mitch told me that if we went to California, everything would be different. In California, legal drinking age was 21. We wouldn't be old enough to drink. They had really strict open container laws. We wouldn't be able to buy booze. We wouldn't be able to drink in a car. We just wouldn't be able to drink. Not that it ever stopped me all those years I drank. When I wasn't of age, somehow or another, my alcoholic mind, it made sense. The other thing that Mitch told me was that he really didn't have any dope in California. So, actually what he said was that all they had out, they didn't have any of those funny little downers, all they had in California was really clean feed and good pot. And I thought, this could work. This could be the answer. We go to California, you know, we'll lay around on the beach, we'll surf a little, we'll smoke the good pot, we'll do the clean feed, this could work out. We put together a phony little drug deal to finance our trip to California. Didn't have a car or transportation or anything else. We stuffed our possessions in duffel bags and we took off for California. We had a grand plan. We got picked up hitchhiking outside of Houston. The guy wasn't going to California. He was going to Austin. He had a big bag of pot, an ice chest full of beer. It seemed like a good idea. It was a small detour. So we ended up here in Austin, Texas. And that's where I hit my bottom, was right here in Austin, Texas. You know, it talks about in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that we come to know the hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And I got to tell you, I came to know them all here in Austin, Texas. And who was messing with me last night about the bridge story? Is that you? Somebody. And the fact of the matter is my drinking ended right down there on Congress. And I was down there just not too long ago to see the bats or whatever. And back then there wasn't bats, or hell, if there were, we didn't know it. But in fact, then underneath that bridge there at Congress on the lake, the winos and bums slept down there. And there's kind of a little park area that's on one side there, and that place was full of winos and bums sleeping in cardboard hard boxes, and that's where it ended up for me. was down there on Congress Avenue. I said my first prayer for help in Austin, Texas, and it was a six screwed up prayer. I stumbled into a church, Mitch and I did, just because it was hot, and it was August, and it was 1982, and we wanted to get out of the heat for a little while, and the church was open, and we went in, and I remember it clear as a bell, just like it was yesterday, and it was a beautiful cathedral, with the big wood ceilings, and the big stained glass windows, and a big cross down front, and we walked down, and I stood in front of that cross, and I cussed God, and I said, F you, if you're there, kill me now. You know, the fact of the matter is I didn't want to die, I just wanted my life to be different, and I could not manage how, I could not imagine how my life could be any different. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about that we get to the jumping off place, and I was at the jumping off place. It talks about that we get to the point where we can't imagine our life with or without alcohol, and I could not manage my life. I could not imagine my life with or without alcohol. I couldn't imagine, not drinking, but I couldn't imagine continuing drinking the way that I was drinking. And that was my first prayer for help. And by a strange chain of events, I ended up back in Houston, Texas, and a few days later, and ended up at my sister's house. And I knocked on her door, and I begged her to let me in, just please, 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 one night. I'll be out of here tomorrow. I promise, I got to have a place to go. She reluctantly acquiesced, and I came in, and she turned her back, and I stole $20 out of her purse. And the only reason it was only 20 was because that was all she had. But that's the kind of alcoholic I was, and a brother, you know, if you helped me, I'd stick you in the back, and if you got between me and a drink, I'd run you over. The fact of the matter is I had a real alcoholic dilemma. I hadn't drank in a few days, and I hadn't ate in a few days, and I needed some of both. And so I stole all the money she had in her purse, and Mitch and I went, got another one of those alcoholic dilemmas, $20, you know, what do you do? So we go to the dope house, and we get some of those funny little pills that we liked, and then we went to the Burger King, and back then they had little 49-cent hamburgers. We got one of those and had them cut it in half. And then we went to the convenience store, and we spent the rest of the money on Tallboy malt liquors, and we sat out on a bus stop bench out in front of that convenience store, and we ate our pills and ate our little half hamburgers, and we drank those beers. And that was my last drunk. I had no idea at the time it was going to be my last drunk, but that was my last drunk. And I got to tell you that, it wasn't enough, you know. It wasn't enough to get me in my preferred state. It wasn't enough to get me to black out, tongue chewing, slobbering on myself drunk. It wasn't enough. But it was enough for me to be able to lie to myself one more time. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks that we get to a position where we can't differentiate true from false. And that's absolutely true. You know, some people describe that as insanity. I don't know, but I do know that that is true. You know, it says that we get to a position where we can't remember the pain and suffering of even a week or a month ago. And we drank those pills and we ate those pills and we drank those beers, and the speck began to come over us, and we began to lie to each other. And we began to tell each other it's all going to be different. Tomorrow we'll get jobs and we'll get an apartment and hell, we'll get laid. You know, I mean, it was all a bunch of alcoholic pipe dreams. And I went back to my sister's house that night, and I laid down and I went to sleep. And the next morning I woke up and I had what we call an Alcoholics Anonymous moment of clarity. For one split second the next morning when I woke up, I saw my life for what it was. For one split second, I saw that if I kept doing what I was doing, I was going to keep getting what I was getting. I saw that if nothing changed, and I knew that something had to be different, and I didn't know what that would be. And I made two phone calls that morning. The first one was to my sister's, whose house I was at, and I said, you know, Karen, you got to help me. What can you do for me? Please, please, please. And she said, you know what? I thought you'd be calling. And I called my husband, and at that time her husband worked overseas, and he says he thinks he can get you a job. Thinking job overseas, this doesn't sound bad. I said, really? Tell me about it. She said, well, yeah, it's in Greenland. I said, Greenland? I'll get right back with you. And the next phone call was to my dad, and I said, Dad, please, you know, you got to help me out. You know, I'm at my end. I need some help here. You know, my dad told me something very profound that morning. He told me that he wasn't willing to be a part of my problem, that he's willing to be part of the solution. He told me that my mom had made him continue to carry health insurance on me, and that if I wanted him to, he would come pick me up, and he would put me in a hospital. I'll get right back with you. And, you know, I'm faced there with one of those decisions. You know, it's Greenland or treatment, Greenland. And, you know, I knew very little about either one of them. Greenland sounded very cold. So I went to treatment. And my dad came and picked me up. And it was a lockdown facility back up in Conroe, as a matter of fact. The old Laurelwood Hospital, Laurelwood. I know. Yeah, Laurelwood alumni I am. I got my $60,000 big book. That tape machine just made some noise. I hope it's okay. Our taper's not in the room. you know, I say that derogatory, but, you know, the fact of the matter is that treatment center really saved my life. They brought me to you people. They brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll be forever grateful for them, although they're not there anymore. And it was a lockdown facility, and I remember going in there and the door slamming shut behind me and thinking, God, what have I gotten myself into? And the fact of the matter is I really didn't want to be there, and I really didn't want to be sober. I wanted my life to be different, but jeez. I mean, they were talking about complete abstinence, and that seemed awful extreme. I thought maybe they could teach me a little control drinking or something else. But they kept me locked in there. And as I said earlier in the doctor's opinion, it says we have a mental obsession that's coupled by a physical craving. And what I spent my first 30 days in that hospital was obsessed with a bottle of drink. I'd wake up every morning, and the first thought that'd run through my mind would be drinking. And I paced the floors, and I rattled the doors. And I thought about, you know, if I could just get out of here. If I could just get out of here, I'm going to drink. I was so irritable. So restless and so discontent. I was so uncomfortable in my skin. And they were taking me to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and people were talking. I wasn't really hearing what they were saying. You know, I remember my first AA meetings. I heard a speaker say one time that at his first AA meeting, everybody said, womp, 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 womp. That was the same meeting I was at. They were talking, but I wasn't hearing it. I think they were talking some foreign language. So if you're new to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and I speak in a foreign language, just let me tell you this. AA absolutely, unequivocally works. AA works. If you don't hear anything else in the course of this meeting, hear that. AA works beyond a shadow of a doubt. We don't always work it, but it works. They were dragging me to meetings, and I, like I said, I was just really just not wanting to be there and really wanting to drink. Fortunately, they kept me locked down long enough that the drugs and the alcohol had the opportunity to clear my system. And I began to eat a little bit and get a little bit more healthy and began to be able to hear a little bit better. And they took me to a big speaker meeting, and it was some big anniversary meeting, and they'd flown a speaker in from Dallas. And this woman, who seemingly had nothing to do with me or no similarity to me, got up and told her story. And during the course of the hour that she spoke, I had an experience. And during the course of the hour that she spoke, I came to believe a couple of things, and those things were that I was an alcoholic. I came to believe that I was an alcoholic. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that we have to concede to our innermost self that we are alcoholic, and that that's the first step in recovery. I'm going to tell you, if you're new to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the most difficult thing we're going to ask you to do is to earn your seat here. It's the most difficult thing we're going to ask you to do is to make that concession. To be able to make that admission that you're alcoholic is the most difficult thing that we're going to ask you to do. Because it's a whole lot harder to get here than it is to stay here, you know. That getting here is a killer. The big book says that alcohol beats us into a state of reasonableness. Unfortunately, it beats some of us to death. It beats some of us to death. But thank God for me, for whatever reason, I was able to come to that realization. And all those excuses why it is that I didn't have alcoholism didn't matter anymore. You know, they talk about in treatment, they like to use the word denial. They say, oh, he's in denial. She's in denial. They're in denial. And the fact of the matter is, the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it doesn't talk about denial. It talks about delusion. You know, it talks about delusion. I got news for you. There's a difference. You may say, oh, you're playing semantics. But the fact of the matter is a difference, you know. Denial is my refusal to believe the truth. You know, I refuse to believe the truth. I'm in denial. Delusion is believing the lie, baby. You know, and I was in delusion. I believed the lie. Every time I drank, I thought it'd be different, and I could tell you why. You know, every time I went back out there and got back in the trenches, I could tell you it'd be different, and I could tell you why. You know, I believed the lie of alcoholism. Fortunately, like I said, though, during the course of that hour, I somehow or another, that stuff washed away, and I could hear finally, and I could see finally, and I could see what was going on, and I came to believe that I was an alcoholic. The other thing that I came to believe during the course of that hour was that Alcoholics Anonymous worked. I knew that AA worked. I didn't know how. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know if it was hocus pocus or magic or what it was, but I could see that there was something here that was working in y'all's lives. And after that meeting was over, they had been talking to me about getting a sponsor. And saying, you need a sponsor. You got to get an AA sponsor. You got to get a sponsor. I didn't know anybody in AA. The only guy I knew in AA was a guy who drove the van. He drove the van for the hospital. His name was Stan. He was Stan the Van Man. And he was the only guy I knew. And he was kind of young. And in 1982, I got to tell you, there weren't a lot of young people in AA. There really weren't. At least the part of town I was in. There were a few, but not a lot. And Stan was in his 30s, and that was pretty young. Stan had hair down on his back, and he kind of looked cool. He had kind of this, you know, little beard, and he kind of looked like those pictures you see of Christ in the church, except like maybe the disciples had turned on him and beat the crap out of him. You know, he's a little bit ruddy, and a little worn for the wear, you know, and he had, but anyway, I went up to Stan. I said, you know, Stan, I need a sponsor. And he said, really, you need a sponsor? I said, yeah, would you be my sponsor? He said, maybe. I said, where are you at in these steps? I said, I know nothing about any steps. And he asked me that day, so you're an alcoholic. And I said, Stan, you know what? I know that I'm an alcoholic. And he asked me that day if I believed in God. And I told him, Stan, I believe you believe. And he told me that was good enough. And that's where it began for me, was an admission that I was an alcoholic and coming to believe that you guys believed. And he told me to go back to my hospital that room that night and to get down on my knees and to make an effort to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And I got to tell you that today I know that there's a third step prayer in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's written very eloquently. So I've said it. I've said it with a lot of men. I've said it a lot of times. At the time, I didn't know anything about any third step prayer. And I got down on that cold hospital floor, kind of looking over my shoulder to see if anybody was watching. And the fact of the matter is I had a roommate, and in treatment, I don't know if y'all have been in treatment. Silly question. they pair you off. They like to pair you off with somebody who has opposing issues or whatever so that your issues will flare or you're in a trouble, have a cat. This, greasy kid off the streets, I'm barely getting the hang of taking a shower every day. We were two opposite extremes. And I remember looking back over my shoulder and he's looking over at me like, what in the hell is that kid doing now? And as I'm down on my knees on that cold hospital floor, the only prayer that came to mind was a prayer from my childhood. And it was, now I lay me down to sleep. If I die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. And I've told that story a million times, and I still can't ever tell that story without feeling it in my heart. And that may sound like crap or whatever, but that's the fact of the matter. I feel it in my heart. And the fact of the matter is that what I did that morning was just a simple childlike act of faith. It was just a simple childlike act of faith. I didn't know the prayer in the book, and I know now that the prayer in the book says that, that these words are optional, and what's important is what your intent is and what's in your heart. And what was in my heart was to surrender myself to a power I had no understanding about. I knew that what you had must have been better than what I had. When I made it to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd have traded places with any of you, sight unseen. I wouldn't even have to look at your life. I'd have traded. I'd have traded places. It's an amazing journey, because I stand before you 18 years later, and there isn't anybody I'd trade places with. There's nobody I trade places with today. Anyway, from that simple childlike act of faith, a miracle happened. And the fact of the matter is that if I was going to stay sober and I was going to make it in the fellowship, I had to be touched by the hand of God. Because as soon as they unlocked those doors, I was going to drink. That's the fact of the matter. And the fact of the matter is AA did touch me. And the next morning when I woke up, I can't tell you what I thought about, but it wasn't drinking. And that was the first day in a long time that I didn't think about drinking. And I spent that whole day and I didn't think about drinking. I spent the next day and I didn't think about drinking. And it was really like 2 weeks later before I realized that I hadn't been thinking about drinking. And it was subtle at the time. And I didn't really realize it. I didn't realize that something had changed. But the fact of the matter is that subtle shift was dramatic. And that subtle shift changed my life to never be the same again. Thanks to the grace of God, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to drink since. They ended up letting me out of that hospital. And, actually, while we were in the hospital, Stan drove the van, and a lot of people in the hospital didn't always want to go to the meetings, but, I was on fire, and every time Stan drove, I was in there, and we'd go to the meetings, and he'd let me sit in the front seat, and Stan and I'd go to the meetings, and, I'd ask him questions, and he'd tell me about Bill and Bob and the old-timers and, the fourth and the fifth step, and I'd go back to the hospital, and the next day they'd be bringing the new guys in. I'd corner them off in the corner of the day room, I'd tell them about Bill and Bob and the old-timers, and the fourth and the fifth step, and I was on fire with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. People in AA in 1982 didn't really know what to think about me. After I had that sheep shearing up there in Conroe, I let my hair grow back, but only in spots. So it's 1982, and the punk rock movement had just kind of begun to come on, and so I had this side of my hair cut real close to my head, and I had this side hung down across my face, kind of going up like this, and this wing cut, and then I had this big rooster tail thing on the back of my head, and I like to wear leather, and I like to wear spikes, and little eye makeup once in a while for special occasions, And I got to tell you, there weren't a lot of people who looked like me in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1982. And we'd go to meetings, and Stan said I had to make friends. And, I'd be coming in the back door, and people would be going, oh, God, he's not going to come over here and talk to us, is he? And, of course, I'd go right up to him. My name's Mark. I need friends. I picked you. They didn't always know what to think about me. But I got on fire with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew that you people here had something that was very special. And I ended up getting out of that hospital, and I got out of the hospital on a Friday, as a matter of fact. And back in those days, I don't hear it that much anymore, but back in those days, they always used to say, how willing are you, brother? How willing are you? Are you willing to go to any length? I don't hear that much anymore, but are you willing to, that's the sandwich, are you willing to go to any length? And there was a young people's conference that weekend when I was getting out of the hospital. It was the Tiki Paw conference up at Lake Whitney. I didn't know what Tiki Paw was. I didn't know where Lake Whitney was. I didn't know what any of that was. And Stan told me why it is I needed to go there. And I tried to explain to him, I'm getting out of the hospital. I don't have a place to live. I don't have a car. I don't have a job. I need to go try to get my life in order. And Stan said, how willing are you, brother? You know. So, I got out of the hospital. I hitchhiked to my parents' house. They were on vacation. So I broke in their house and I stole my mom's car and, picked up my old buddy Mitch because I was going to 12-step him and, took him to Lake Whitney. And that was my first weekend out of treatment was I went to a Tiki Paw at Lake Whitney in a stolen car with my old friend who smoked pot all the way there and went off in the woods and smoked pot. And I justified that. You know, we had to stop before we left town so he could get a little weed. And I remembered hearing in the hospital they were talking about old timers who used to carry bottles in their trunks for the new guys when they came in. And to me it was the same thing, you know. He needed something to take the edge off, so, he snuck off in the woods at Lake Whitney and stayed high all weekend, and the fact of the matter is I stayed sober. And it's only by the grace of God that I stayed sober. You know, I'd like to stand before you and tell you, you know, beat myself on the chest and pat myself on the back and all the great things that I've done in sobriety to stay sober, but I'm here to tell you, I am sober today because God is merciful and gracious. And that's the fact of the matter. It's only by God's grace and mercy that I'm sober today. You know, I didn't understand that for a long time in sobriety. I really didn't. I thought I was sober by my works. I thought it was sober by the things I did. Well, don't you see, I've worked these steps, and I've worked with alcoholics, and I've done all these other things. But the fact of the matter is I've seen too many people come in and out of this fellowship. It's only by grace that I'm sober today. You know, mercy means that that God doesn't give me what I deserve. And grace means God gives me what I don't deserve. And that's the fact of the matter. My sobriety is an unmerited gift, and that's grace. I came back to Houston after that conference, and I didn't have a place to live. I didn't have an apartment. I didn't have a car. I didn't have nothing. I took my mom's car home, made amends later. If you're new in sobriety, don't worry about it. There's not hardly anything you do that you can't clean up with amends, so just have a good time. Sit down, Chris. My parents were on vacation, and I went to my dad's office. My mom and dad owned a business, and they were on vacation. My old man, you know, he had run me off from his, and I worked for him when I was a kid, but my old man had run me off from his business years before. I mean, he didn't want nothing to do with me around there, and, you know, they were on vacation, so I went there and I sweet-talked the office manager in true alcoholic manipulative form and just convinced her, please, 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 just the 2 weeks while they're out of town, let me work here, I need some money. She agreed that I would work there for the next 2 weeks. So I did. I worked for the next 2 weeks, and I worked real hard. And Dad came back from vacation. He didn't tell me not to come back, so I just kept going back. And he didn't tell me not to come back, so I just kept going back. And he didn't tell me not to come back, so I just kept going back. And it's been 18 years. I think I'm probably safe now. But I started working, and it really was. I backdoored my way into a job, and I moved in with some members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I slept on the couch, and that was the beginning of it for me. In the first 6 months of sobriety, I was on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was out there going to a bazillion meetings a day, and you know, carrying the message at every turn, and doing everything it was I could do. And at 6 months sober, I got to tell y'all that for some families, alcoholism is a family secret. But in my family, it just wasn't much of a secret. Because people would say things to my parents all the time like, is that boy on dope? Because when you drank and used the way that I drank and used, it just wasn't too much secretive about it. And the fact of the matter is I had embarrassed my mother and father in ways that are unthinkable. I had embarrassed them in front of so many people in so many situations by my actions and behavior. And so by the time I'm 6 months sober, my mom is pretty excited, you know. You would have thought she was so proud of me. You'd have thought I graduated from Harvard. I mean, she, you know, I was it, you know. And she would call people on the phone, and she would call all these old people that I'm sure I'd embarrassed in front of at one time or another, and tell them, "Oh yeah, Mark's doing so good. He's in AA now. He has a sponsor. He's working for his dad. He's working the step. Oh, he's doing so good. Yada 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 yada." And she made a phone call one day to somebody who had a kid that was my age, who I'd actually drank and used with, and of course she ran through the litany of, you know, her son's recent successes in Alcoholics Anonymous and his, you know, newfound sobriety. And the other mother said, you know, well, my daughter has moved back into the house, and she has moved back here from California. This girl had run away and run to California and actually made it. But she was back in the house with her mom, and she said, you know, do you think Mark would take my daughter to some of those meetings? And so she said, absolutely, I'm sure he will. So she calls me on the phone, and I'm thinking, this is it. This is my first 12-step call. I'm on fire, you know. Take a woman with me, call Stan, forget all that. Hell, I'd read Working with Others in the book. I knew what it was all about. I jumped in the car and freighted over there, you know. I load her up in the car and take her to a meeting, you know, tell her about Bill and Bob and the old-timers and break it all down to her. I got to tell you, Chuck, my intentions were good. My motives were pure. But slowly that 12-step call turned into a 13-step call. And, you know, I got to say, it was Boy Meets Girl on AA campus. And we started dating and doing the deal. And you know what that's like. And, you know, of course, I didn't talk to Stan about it in advance, you know. And here again, if you're new in sobriety, let me tell you, you know, it's much easier to get forgiveness than permission. So if it's questionable, don't ask your sponsor because he's going to say no. Go ahead, he'll have to forgive you. And the fact of the matter, what Stan told me when I did finally talk to him about it, what Stan did tell me was that he said, boy, you just got your pecker in one hand and your umbilical cord in the other and you're just looking for a place to plug in. And, you know, I didn't think it was such a bad thing as long as I could keep up with what was in what hand, you know. Yeah, the fact of the matter is the relationship made perfect sense to me. You know, I'm 6 months sober. I'm ready to rewrite the big book. I'm going to the meetings. I'm telling the old-timers how to do it. You know, she's due to pick up a desire chip any day. You know, I'm thinking we're a match made in heaven. And that was the beginning of a relationship that lasted about 5 years. And her and I ended up moving in together. We ended up getting married. We ended up having a child together. And then we ended up getting a divorce. And, you know, something happened over that five-year period that I began to separate myself from Alcoholics Anonymous, and it happened slowly. At first, you know, she did sober up, I sobered her up, damn it, you know, and we were, you know, a happy young people couple in AA, and we went to lots of meetings, and we were involved, and went to the dances, and did all this stuff, and, you know, it was all good, but slowly along the way, I began to lose perspective on what was important in my life, what was really important in my life, and what was really meaningful, and what was really necessary in order for me to stay sober and sane, And as I did that, I began to withdraw from Alcoholics Anonymous, and as I withdrew from Alcoholics Anonymous, I got sick. I mean, that's the fact of the matter. And the sicker I got, the worse that relationship got. You know, it talks about in our book that we place too much dependency on other people, and I began to place my dependency on her and that relationship, and the more dependency I placed on her, the more she failed me, and the more she failed me, the worse the relationship got. I didn't completely remove myself from AA, but I did. Stan had moved off, and I didn't get a new sponsor. I didn't really have a home group. I would drop into a meeting once in a while. I still had friends in AA, and I still had some service commitment, and I still stayed active to some extent, but really wasn't active. I was active in fellowship and in unity and service, but I really wasn't active in recovery. And anyway, we ended up going through a divorce, and I got to tell you, it was absolutely unequivocally the most painful thing I've ever been through in my life, drunk or sober. It was terrible. I'm 6 years sober, I guess, at the time, and it just damn near killed me. And, you know, we talk about in AA, and it's not in the literature, and I don't want to get into controversy, I don't really care what, you know, it's all on a personal journey, but, you know, we talk about in AA that we should spend a year alone, and I didn't spend a year alone. And at 6 years sober, I got an opportunity to spend a year alone. And the fact of the matter is that when that relationship was over and the pain that I was going through, it wasn't about the pain of losing her and losing that relationship. It was about the pain and the fear of the fact that I was alone. And for the first time in my life, I was really going to be alone. I got a new sponsor, and the new sponsor, thank God I made it back, you know, and I just kind of threw myself back into AA and started going to meetings, and a bunch of stuff happened, and I'll explain some of those things, but I got a new sponsor, and my sponsor wanted me to make a commitment to stay out of a relationship for a year. And I got to tell you, I thought it was a sentence. I mean, you know, we had this plea bargain that ensued after that, you know, and we negotiated this thing down, and I managed to negotiate it down to 6 months, and So I thought I did pretty good in that. But the fact of the matter is 6 months ended up turning into a year, and a year ended up turning into 18 months. It was absolutely the best time I had in my life. It was the best thing I could have done for myself. You know, when her and I split up, I didn't think I was going to make it. And I was alone for the first time, and I knew that it was going to be me and God. I knew it was going to be me and God, and I didn't know if I was enough. I didn't know if I was enough. But I got to learn over the course of that 18 months that me and God are enough. And that, you know, relationships come and go, and maybe they happen and maybe they don't. But for me today, they're the icing on the cake, and, you know, they're what makes life pretty, but they're not what makes life necessary. And I didn't know that for a long time because, you know, I got so much of who I was through who you were, And so much of my identity from a relationship, I don't want to get too deep in all that, but you know, it was very tough for me to sort through that stuff and to really realize that my dependency needed to be placed on God and that God would take care of all my needs, all my needs. And God did some miraculous things for me during that period of time. We started late, so I'm going to, I know it's fast, a little bit after 10, but I'm going to try to move fast now. But we did start late. God did some miraculous things for me that time. There's a guy named Bob W., the bug man, came to me during that period of time, and I'm miserable. I gotta tell you, I'm miserable. I just wanna die, you know. In fact, some days, you know, it would just wash over me. The pain would just wash over me. I'd think, man, I'm just gonna drink. You know, I'm just gonna drink. My next thought would be, man, that doesn't work for you. You're an alcoholic. You know, drinking's not an option for you. And I think, man, I'm just gonna blow my brains out. And I'd just go to an AA meeting. And during the course of the hour of that AA meeting, something would happen, and I would feel a little bit better when it was over. And this thing was, you know, this process that I was going through was very painful, and it was very slow, and it was very arduous. But Bob came to me during this period of time, and he said, you know what, Mark, there's a bunch of young people over at this AA group, and what we need to do is start a young people's conference. I'm like, you are so crazy. Don't you see how miserable I am? I'm not getting involved with any of that. And he wouldn't leave it alone, and he kept coming back, and he kept coming back, and he kept bugging me about it. So we did. We started the Houston Conference of Young People in AA, and I chaired the first two, and we had two fundraisers, and we threw a conference, and you know, it was a hell of a deal. We didn't have any idea what we were doing. We were pretty clueless to it. And this year will actually be the 14th annual Houston Conference of Young People in AA. We were pretty clueless. We didn't have any idea what we were doing. Like I said, we threw two fundraisers, and we had a conference, and you know, the first one was a bust. We registered like 290 people, but we didn't know it, but the treasurer had been paying her rent all year out of checkbook, and we were too stupid. We didn't have any checks and balances. We had no idea. So we get down to the end of it, and we're broke. And, you know, I was the voice of the first conference. We wore a lot of hats. You had to wear a lot of hats if you were on a conference committee back in those days. And so I was the voice of the conference. And Saturday night, there's like almost 300 people in the room, so it's a pretty good crowd. And we're broke. And so Bob's passing the basket, and he'd collect the money. He'd come back here behind the podium, and he'd count it down. And he'd go, send it again. I said, all right, brothers, we'll go on one more time. Dig deep now. We send the basket around again. On the fourth time around, he's back here, and I'm looking. He's, you know, there's 50s and 100s in there. He's like, these people are sick of this, you know. And we ended up paying the conference expenses that night. And the next year, we threw another conference. But I got to tell you, you know, that was the best thing that could have possibly happened for me. I had a place to be on Sunday, and I had a commitment, and I had a group of people who were counting on me. You know, there's a girl from my old home group who used to say Deirdre D. And in fact, her sponsor Lois P. takes credit for this, but I think it was original with Deirdre. But she used to say back when she was 16-year-old Valley girl. Whole another story. But I'm sitting in a meeting one day, and she says, "You know what? God fixes me when I'm not looking." And it just hit me right between the eyes. I was like, "You know what? You're absolutely right. God fixes me when I'm not looking. When I'm trapped in my stuff and my business and right in here, nothing changes. When I'm focused on me and I'm in that old selfish, self-centered ways, nothing changes. It's when I forget about me just for a little while and I pay attention to you just for a little while, everything changes. Everything changes." And what that conference did was it gave me an opportunity not to think about me just for a little while. I had a commitment, I had places to go, and there were things to do, and we did functions and had things, you know, we were planning and going to conferences to see how they did it, and et cetera, et cetera, and it kept me busy. And we're at one of those early fundraisers for that conference, and we're in a big room. We used to have huge dances back then. We're in a big room up in the Woodlands, and I mean, the room is just packed full of people, and the, you know, the lights are on, and the smoke's going, and there's this guy coming at me from across the room, you know, and he's got hair down on his back, and he's got a pair of ratty shorts on, and no shoes, and an untucked shirt, and a little fuzz on his lip, he thinks it's a mustache, and he's walking straight for me, and he has that, "I want to talk to you," look in his eye, and of course I'm doing the, "Oh God, he's not coming over here, is he?" You know, so he walks up to me, and he says, "Whoa, dude, somebody said you'd make an excellent sponsor." Thinking, "Oh God, who did I piss off?" You know, I said, "Maybe." And you know, we went outside to talk, and I said, "Tell me what's going on in your life." And he said, "You know, man, I'm in high school, but I want to quit. I got a job, but I want to quit that too. I live with my parents. I think I'm going to move out. I want to move to Galveston and surf." I'm thinking, this guy is none too bright, you know. At least, you know, I wanted to go to California, you know. The fact of the matter, y'all have all been to Galveston. You know, you can fart in a bathtub and make a bigger wave there is in Galveston, you know what I mean? I at least wanted to go to California. I said, "You know, wait a minute, just one day, maybe just one day, don't do any of those things and call me tomorrow.
Oh, dude, I'm going to call you, okay?
And so he goes off. I'm thinking, I've done my duty, you know. I've been to good AA. Some of us is never going to call. I'm off the hook. And lo and behold, he calls the next day.
Well, dude, what's up?
And, you know, the fact of the matter, based on the description that I've given you, if that man walked in the room right now, you wouldn't recognize him. And that's Brian's sponsor and one of the guys I've sponsored for a really long time. And his name's Sean, and a lot of y'all know Sean. And, you know, Sean today is a fireman and a paramedic, and he's married, and he lives in a nice home, and he has all the trappings of life that certainly didn't seem possible to a 16-year-old kid who could barely put a sentence together. It's an amazing journey. It's an amazing journey. You know, Sean didn't quit high school one day at a time. He went to high school, and I got to be there one day at a time. I told the story the other day, and I was thinking, and Sean and I talked about it the other day because I told him I told it on him, but I remember one time when he was in high school, he calls me one day, and it's in the middle of the day, and I'm at the office. He's like, whoa, dude, what's up? I'm like, what are you doing? Why aren't you in school? What are you doing calling me? He's like, whoa, dude, I got a deal worked out with the principal, man. He knows that I'm in recovery in AA, and if I'm having a bad day, I just go talk to him. He lets me go home so I won't drink. I said, man, that is not the way we do it in Alcoholics Anonymous. You need to go back and make amends to your principal, and you need to get your ass back to school. Fact of the matter is, one day at a time, Sean didn't quit school, he didn't move out of his parents' house, he didn't quit his job, he didn't do any of those things. One day at a time, I got to share with him the experience that was given to me. I got to share with him the steps as they're expressed in the first 164 pages of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a result of that process, miracles began to happen in his life. Sean graduated from high school, and I was there that night, and I was standing in the back of the room, and I was standing up on a chair in the back of the room, and I was screaming and yelling like an idiot. You know, I never graduated from high school. I dropped out in the ninth grade, but I got to tell you, there was a small little piece of me that walked across the stage with Sean that night. There was a small little piece of me that picked up a degree that night. I felt like it was heartfelt and hard-fought and earned, damn it. Sean decided he wanted to be a fireman, and we packed him up and we sent him off to Texas A&M, and he studied fire science, and I got to be there when he graduated from that, and I got to be there when he came back from A&M, and he got his first job, and et cetera, et cetera. I got to be there when he got married. I was his best man at his wedding. I got to be there when he bought his home. I was at the closing table with him. I've had the opportunity to see Alcoholics Anonymous work in this man's life. And he's just one of the guys that I sponsored that God put in my life, and they put him in my life exactly when I need him. You know, I was in such a pitiful state at that point, and, you know, God sent me some 16-year-old kid who couldn't find his butt with both hands, and it saved my life. It saved my life. And I got to not think about me for a little while, and I got to think about somebody else. You know, the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, actually in 12 and 12, it talks about it, describes it as self-forgetting. You know, there used to be a guy early in my sobriety that didn't call it self-forgetting, he called it getting out of your cheap-ass self, and that was his favorite thing. He'd say, Mark, get out of your cheap-ass self. But that's what it's all about, getting out of self, forgetting about me and paying attention to somebody else. You know, like I said, Sean is just one of the guys, and I've had the opportunity and the pleasure to sponsor a lot of men, and I've had the opportunity to see those miracles happen in all those guys' lives, and it's been a great journey. I told you in the beginning of my talk that my dad was an alcoholic, and that's not by my admission, that's by his. And at about 8 years sober, I'm 8 years sober, and I'm watching my dad, and he's trying to drink up the business. He's doing everything he can to just slam it. He's coming in at, you know, 10 or 11 o'clock and screaming and yelling at the employees, and he's, you know, going out to the bars for a liquid lunch, and sometimes he'd make it back in by 5, and sometimes he wouldn't. And Mom was calling every day, doing the untreated Al-Anon freak, and, you know, where's your dad, what's he doing, you know, et cetera, et cetera, and it was just insane. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about that, you know, our family members were usually the last ones that could help him, and I had to sit on my hands and I had to watch him do that. I had to watch him die a day at a time, and, man, it was just so hard for me to do. And I gotta tell you, at about 8 years sober, he came in the office one morning and he had that look in his eye, you know, that look that alcoholics know, that look of, I don't know if I can do this one more day. And I had the opportunity to go to him, and I had the opportunity to say to him what he had said to me a bunch of years before. And I had the opportunity to say, Dad, I know another way, and you know I do. I'm not willing to be a part of the problem, but I'm willing to be a part of the solution. I'll take you to a meeting if you want to go. You know, I knew that I couldn't work the steps with my dad, and I couldn't do AA with him, but what I did know is I could bring him to you. And he said he wanted to go, and I loaded him up in a car, and I took him to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Houston. And he heard his story. He heard it several times. And when the meeting was over, he was mad at me because he thought I had called ahead and told him that he was coming and what his story was. You know, he's like, what did you tell those people all that about me for? And, you know, the fact of the matter is my dad's been sober ever since, and that's been over 10 years now. So, I mean, what a journey. you know, what a journey to get to see my old man sober up, and the relationship that ensued as a result of that between he and I, and the friendship that we developed. You know, my parents, I told you in the beginning of my talk, or somewhere along the way, that my parents owned a business, and about 5 or 6 years ago they came to me, I guess it's been longer than that now, maybe it's been 5 or 6 years, I don't know, but they came to me and asked me if I wanted an ownership interest in the business, and I gotta tell you, you know, it's not a big deal, it's not some big Fortune 500 big, you know, deal, it's not, it's a small business. The money's not what it's about, the size of the company's not what it's about, the fact of the matter is my mom and dad trust me today. And they asked me if I wanted ownership interest in the business, and they gave me 50% ownership in the business, as a matter of fact. And, you know, today my mom and dad are retired, and they have a big motor home, and they travel the country full time. I think now they're in Nevada, but they're always somewhere different, and they just travel all the time. And you know what? They don't call and ask me about the business. They don't worry about it. They're not concerned about it. They know that I'm here, and they trust me, and they know that I'm going to do what's right. I'm going to do what's right for their future and their retirement and with our business. And, you know, what a deal that is. I got to tell you, I'm the guy that sold my mama's TV. I'm the guy that if she turned her back, I took every penny out of her pocket. I'm the guy that, you know, raided my dad's rare coin collection and spent it on dope. You know, I mean, that's the guy I am, you know. And the fact of the matter is today my parents trust me, you know. They trust me because of lessons I've learned in here, and I've learned in men's meetings and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've learned from you guys. You know, I've learned how to be a decent son. Learned how to be a good son. I'm not a great son, but I'm a good son. I've learned how to be a good son, and I've learned it from you people. I've learned it by your example and by through good sponsorship. You know, some people say we work the amends steps and it's over, and I don't know. Maybe we do, maybe we don't. But for me, there's some amends that just keep on giving. And, you know, like I told you all early on, I embarrass my mother and father in ways that are unthinkable, and that's the amends I continue to make to them. You know, I go to work every day. I go to work every day and I try to be a good son. I put a check in the bank for them on Friday. You know, I make a living amends to them. And, you know, I try to be, I told you I had a daughter. I try to be a good father to my daughter, and I try to be a good brother to my sisters and a good uncle to my nieces and nephews. And I fall short. I'm not perfect, but I do try. I try to do the best I can one day at a time. And those are the amends that I try to make to my family by ongoing, continuing to have those relationships. I know that I'm way over, well, not really way over. I said we did start early, but we're just so late, but I'm going to try to wrap it down a little bit here. But I'd be remiss if I didn't tell y'all a little bit about what's going on right now today. Almost 2 years ago, I met a new woman. I wasn't looking for her when I found her. Actually, that's not true. I was looking for her. We had the pleasure of hosting the 42nd International Conference of Young People in AA in Houston, Texas. I know that some of y'all were there, and I know some of y'all were a little involved with that. During the course of that conference, there were some young women who were on the committee, and we were on a break at one of those six-hour committee meetings, and I'm sitting on a couch, and this young woman comes up, and she says, are you dating anybody? And I said, I'm not. Do you want to fix me up? And she said, you know what? As a matter of fact, I do. And she fixed me up on a blind date with a woman that she worked with. And she worked at a regional council on alcoholism, and she was an alcohol counselor. And she fixed me up with one of her coworkers, who happened to be a woman who was a drug and alcohol counselor, but it's not in AA. She's not in recovery. She's not an alcoholic. We had a couple phone conversations. Like I say, I called this woman on the phone. She had the voice of an angel. And we had great phone conversations. And I went down to pick her up, and I knocked on the door, and she opened the door, and she did just, you know, you never know. I don't know if any of those guys have been on blind dates or not, but you never know what's going to be on the other side of it. You know, she had been described as a woman with a great personality. I thought I was in trouble, you know. But the fact of the matter is she opened the door and it took my breath away. I mean, she was absolutely gorgeous. I mean, she's a beautiful woman. And she smiled, her big, beautiful smile, and my heart fell out. And that began a romance like I've never experienced. And we began to date, and we began to see one another, and we began to move forward. And a year ago, New Year's, for the millennium, we got engaged, and now we're getting married, and that's just like a couple weeks from now. We're going to get married on Thanksgiving Day, and I'm really excited about that. You know, and the fact of the matter is that relationship's not perfect. I don't think any relationship's perfect, but I do think that that relationship may be right size. I'm in a relationship with a woman today who understands my disease but doesn't suffer from it. I'm in a relationship with a woman today who has a strong relationship with a loving God. And she's been able to share her relationship with God, and I've been able to share my program with her, and we've been able to both grow from that. And I'm going to tell this little one, and I'm going to shut up, but we, you know,
somewhere along the way in our relationship, she came to me and asked me if we could pray together. And I got to tell you, it scared the hell out of me. And I said the third step and prayed with a lot of men in sobriety, but this woman wants us to pray together. And I'm a funky, nasty alcoholic man. That's the fact of the matter. You know, we'll go out on our first date, and, you know, I'll rip all my clothes off, and we'll just get naked, and we'll do every intimate act that we could possibly do together. Do you want to pray with me? Whoa, slow down, baby. Don't move too fast now. And, you know, we began to pray together, and we pray together now every day. And that's been a real growing experience, to be able to share my relationship with God with her, and for her to be able to share her relationship with God for me, and for us to be able to put God first in our relationship. You know, God's here and we're here and we're both growing towards God, and as we grow towards God, we grow closer together. And that's the fact of the matter. I mean, that's what our experience has been. And our prayers have been very sincere along the way, of just surrendering our relationship and just seeking God's will, and knowing that that God will do what's best for us. And you know, we're fixing to get married. So I don't know what the future will hold. I don't know what that'll be, you know. I know that I love this woman madly and deeply, and I know that I'm a romantic at heart, and I know that I thank God for putting her in my life. And I really, really believe that it was God's will to put her in my life. And if it was God's will to put her in my life, it'll be God's will to change us in our relationship. So anyway, I just got tapped out, so my time is up. This has been an interesting morning, and I really appreciate y'all being here to listen to me, because there's two parts to this, you know, speaker meeting. There's speakers and listeners, and so, you know, I guess I was a speaker, but it wouldn't have been much of a meeting without some listeners, so I appreciate you guys getting out of bed and coming down here this morning. Again, I want to thank the TexiPaw committee. I want to thank you guys for your hard work and your effort and for keeping TexiPaw alive and keeping it well. It is something that I owe a lot to. And I'm going to close the way that I always close, and that's when I was going through that really, really, really painful time in my life, and I was hurting real bad. That guy Bob W. came to me, and he asked me if I wanted to know the secret of love. And I felt so unloved and so unworthy of love. I said, absolutely, Bob, I want to know the secret of love. And Bob told me that the secret of love is not to be loved, but it's to reach out and love somebody else. And I love you guys.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
Got a few announcements. The marathon meeting is in room 137. The hospitality room is 141. If you have a room here or at the Super 8, please let registration know. Unfortunately, there are no more rooms here. But if you do want one, Super 8 has. Smoking's not permitted in the hotel. There's a very large area outside. Please wear your badge to all functions.
Oh, please, Mark. Yes, Daddy.
Oh. if you have any friends that want to go to the dances, please invite them. There'll be a $5 fee for the dance. Got a little thing, something here for you, Mark. Thank you very much for speaking today. What do you mean? So what went in my throat?
Thank you.
Oh, a mug! And a little thingamabobber in it.
Oh, thank you so much.
There are tapes available at the back. There. You can receive a tape of Mark directly at this meeting for $5 each to any of the speakers. And there also will be 8 talks available that go out through the conference for $30. And, not to forget about, the best conference there will be, no, not Hickey. It'll be Hickey, Hickey, Hickey. Pa, pa, pa. I'll be playing next game, that's all I've got to say. Look no further for Utopia will be the theme of this conference. It'll be a great conference, there's great dances, karaoke, and everything is just so much fun in Houston. Come on out, have a good time. Thank you very much.
Are we going to
close in the usual manner?